Accession number 32297, Reel 6.
John Dixon, Reel 2.
Landing at night, how do you assess landing at night? Is it...
You're asking me to remember something which I'm finding a little bit difficult. I think we had something that was called a glide scope indicator, which was placed at the downwind end of the runway, facing you as you made your approach. So you were approaching into wind. And this glide scope indicator, you could only see it when you were below a certain height. I can't remember the height, but let's say 300 feet. And this showed you, if it showed red, it was rather like a traffic signal, I suppose. If it showed red, then that told you you were probably too low on your approach. Presumably, if it showed green, you knew you were on the right sort of lines. And if it showed some other colour, I don't know, maybe it was amber, I don't know. But if it was that one, then you knew you were too high. And by that, you could sort of get yourself onto a nice, gentle letdown. But at the same time, what you were doing, you saw these gooseneck flares, and they probably had, half a dozen of them stretched along the length of the landing thing. And if you can picture, as you're coming in, If these gooseneck flares appear to be very far apart, you're probably too high. But if they, at the lower you get, so they appear to come closer together. And that's another way of doing it. But I didn't find it too difficult, night flying. Quite enjoyed it, going off on my own, flying round, as long as I didn't lose the airfield.
And cross-countries, did you do cross-countries?
We did cross-countries, yes. Initially you went with an instructor. You spent quite a bit of time in the crew room before you actually climbed into the aeroplane, and he told you where you were going, and you drew your courses out on a map. You worked out the courses you were going to fly. You were told what the estimated wind would be, so you allowed for that. And you knew the time that you were going to take on each leg of this cross country, depending on the speed that you were flying. So then it became just a question of a steady speed, a steady height, and map reading, of course. So you had your map and you just checked. Normally you flew from one aerodrome to another, and you just did this, and you had probably two or three goes at this with an instructor, different places to fly to, and then you did it on your own, and eventually you had to do what was the most exciting thing, which was to land away. And you flew, and I think in my case was to an aerodrome called Desford. I can't remember where that is now, but somewhere up in the Midland. And the idea was you flew there, you joined the circuit, making quite sure you paid attention to all the rules for landing, and you landed, taxied over to a control hut where there was some probably very bored sergeant or somebody sitting there, and you said to him, "Excuse me, sergeant, could you sign my chit?" And he signed a chit that you'd landed your Tiger Moth at such and such a time on such and such a day. And then he got back to his copy of The Sun or whatever he was reading, and he left you to take off. And that was it. And you came back and showed your instructor your little chit that he'd signed. And that was it. So you'd done your first landing away from the and that was quite good.
So once you made your calculations and you took off, and would you navigate then using the map and visually on the ground?
Oh yes, you've got to do that. You knew from your calculations the course you were going to steer, but of course that could vary a bit depending on the wind, and often you had to, if there was a lot of cloud about, you sometimes had to divert a little bit if you didn't want to fly through the cloud. So you were map reading, map reading was in those days was mainly done by railways, because there were plenty of railways in those days, and every town had got a railway coming into it. Now, did the railway come in from the west or from the east or north? Did it have a junction? Was there a rail junction there? If there was, where were they going? And this is how you recognise towns from the railways mainly, and any other main feature, because the maps always showed you things like forests and woods and lakes, so you could often locate a town by whether there was a big lake or a forest coming up this way. Motorways didn't exist, so but today you'd probably navigate by the motorway.
Throughout this period, obviously, you've explained that you had ground instruction,
yes,
as well, and the way that your days were divided.
Yeah.
What subjects were you covering in the ground instruction?
I wish I could remember. Well, obviously, we kept going with things like aircraft recognition. We kept going with navigation, obviously, working out courses, winds, and allowing for variation, compass deviation, all these sort of things that are built in. What else did we do?
Did you do any meteorology?
Yes. Yeah, you know more about it than I do. Yeah, I think we did. We certainly learned all about clouds, the different types of clouds. I wish I could remember what they are now, but we certainly learned that. And you learnt to judge the weather. In other words, you could see if clouds were building up in a certain pattern, and the way the clouds were forming, you could get the impression as to whether you were going to get some very bad weather or not. All this, of course, you've got to remember that these were the days when you didn't fly very high. You know, if you flew much above 5,000 or 6,000 feet, you were really going. I mean, later on, I don't say the weather didn't matter. Of course it did, but you could always climb above any weather. And if you diverted because of heavy cloud or something, you could always relocate on radio and beacons and that sort of thing. But in these days, it was very much a question of keeping your eye on the ground, really.
But it was an idea, obviously, the meteorology and the weather recognition, that sort of thing. Is it just to give you a kind of awareness that you could be running into pretty poor weather if you're heading in that direction?
Yeah. Oh, yes, that sort of thing. Because if I remember, we didn't have pre-flight briefings like we did later on, when you didn't take off unless you'd had some chat from a meteorologist or a weatherman to tell you what to look out for. It was all very sort of hit and miss. But obviously, you didn't deliberately take risks. I mean, there were stories told of chaps going up with their instructor, going up above the clouds to do their aerobatics or whatever, and then finding that they had to come down through cloud, which, of course, was always a hairy sort of thing to do, because you never know, you don't want to fly into a hill when you come through. And it was something that they didn't ever encourage you to do when you were going solo. If you had an instructor with you, he would have the skills probably to know where roughly where he was and what to come down. But you know, looking back to later on in my career, we never found it a huge problem, the weather.
During this first part of the elementary training, were there any was there anybody who was not suitable and failed at this?
Oh, yes, we did. Yes, it's surprising how people got weeded out. I think, going to the very extreme, I think it was the course in front of me, we had one poor lad who actually crashed a tiger moth and killed himself. Now, how on earth you could do that, I don't know, because it was virtually impossible to crash an aeroplane. But anyway, that was one thing. But no, you were asking, were people failed? Yes, they were. People were obviously, well, I suppose the truth of the matter is they probably were uncoordinated. you know, I'm just going on a bit now, thinking of my own son. Not that he ever wanted to necessarily be a pilot, but he did some skits and training with his cadet when he was at school, and this was in the 1960s, and he was brilliant on all the academic side. He walked through it, and they sent him to Biggin Hill to do these coordination things, and he couldn't do it. You know, it was. I suppose, I don't know, it just, some people just found it very difficult.
And there's no way of knowing that, is there, till they start the training?
No way of knowing that. They've changed it now, of course. I mean, they don't start you off until they know that you're reasonably coordinated. The other thing, of course, and I think I mentioned this earlier, you did find the odd bod that was airsick. And that was quite sad, because you know how do you know you're going to be airsick, and if it was that bad, well, there was no point in training you either as a pilot or as an observer if you were going to be airsick all the time. So we lost one or two like that.
Was there anybody who had problems with, I mean, landing? I've heard is one of the main problems that people tended to have, that they couldn't get right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was. Well, that was, yeah, the general flying skills. They gave you, I mean, we were all terrified of failing, obviously, and you check with your mates all the time when they'd gone solo and all this, and you worried if you hadn't gone solo and all this. But they did give you plenty of time. If your instructor genuinely felt that you could do it, but were probably being terribly nervous or wound up about it, and the fact that you were going on a solo test or something, you probably tensed up and found things not going according to plan. If that was a situation, he didn't just write you off. He handed you over to another instructor who could probably be a bit more sympathetic. And he'd probably get in and say to the chap, "Now, come on, old lad, what's the problem? Let's see what we can sort out," and treat it very, very gently. And more often than not, that might just do the trick, just sort of take the tension out of the situation. But if you still couldn't do it, I mean, and some were never going to make it, well, sadly, that was it. They had to be scrubbed off the course. We did lose a few. Mm.
Did they disappear relatively quickly when they were scrubbed from the course? They didn't, or did they hang around at all?
Oh, no, they were gone. They were gone, yes. I can't honestly remember anybody on our course, but we did lose some, I know. But they just suddenly, they weren't there. And whatever happened to them, I don't know. As I may have mentioned before, you probably, if you were lucky, and you had done very well at ground school, they might retrain you as an observer. That would be the best answer. But failing that, back to the fleet as a sailor, I suppose.
Were you given, towards the end of the course, a chief instructor's flight?
Yeah, we had a CFI, chief flying instructor test. That came just before you passed out of the course, and I think I've got it in my logbook as a final test or something, and that was always something that you did worry about a bit, because the chief instructor was obviously a bit of a disciplinarian. He was probably flight lieutenant or even squadron leader, I don't know, fairly senior pilot anyway, and he didn't want to mess about. And he just took you up for probably 3/4 of an hour, and you had to do everything you'd been taught, you know, aerobatics, spins, starting the engine in flight, and all the things that we'd been taught. We had to show him that we'd mastered it, and then he signed you off. And that, when I left Elmden, I think I'd flown for all of 66 hours, which was an enormous achievement, wasn't it? We thought we were the bee's knees.
Did you have leave at the end of the
Yes, I think we did. It's not recorded in any logbook, but I think we must have had a couple of weeks leave. And then we knew we were going to Canada for the rest of our training. And I don't know whether we went up as a group or whether we made our own way individually. I can't remember this, but we ended up at Morecambe, a seaside resort, which you probably have heard of. And we were still under the control of the RAF, of course, and they had requisitioned, if that's the word, various bedrooms in boarding houses. These seaside ladies, who obviously couldn't have any customers when the war was on, they were letting off their rooms on an ad hoc basis, I suppose, to the RAF. I don't know whether I had a room to myself in a house or whether the two of us were sharing, but this is where we were, in these boarding houses. And I cannot remember, I've been racking my brain since I saw you, did the seaside landlady give us breakfast? I can't remember, but all I remember is that every day you had to parade on the promenade, I suppose, and some sergeant or other probably counted heads to make sure you were all there. And if he had got nothing more to tell you, you were free for the rest of the day. And there must have been a mess hall or somewhere, because I'm sure the seaside landladies didn't give us dinner. So we must have had a mess hall. But how long we were there at Morecambe, I don't know. It was probably a couple of weeks. But all we were doing, you see, was waiting for a ship to take us across to Canada. And nobody knew how long that might be. So fortunately it was summer, and although the beach, as I remember, was barricaded off with barbed wire and all that sort of thing, there were odd young ladies who were there having their summer holidays, and they seemed quite interested in flying sailors. So the time passed reasonably comfortably, and there was the odd dance or something to go to. And then one morning, obviously at this parade we went to, we were told, pack your bags, get everything ready, because you're leaving tonight. And on a special train, but nobody told us where we were going. So my memory is we all piled into this train with our kit bags, and off we went into the night, and we must have had some sort of sleep, I suppose, during this journey. And it was obvious from the sun and the stars or whatever that we were going north. We knew we were going north, and we woke up at the crack of dawn. It turned out that we were in Greenock, which is, on the Clyde. But we still didn't know which ship we were going to go in. Nobody ever told you anything. It could have been anything.
When had you been made aware that you were going to Canada? Was that something that
we knew that from the beginning. When we left St. Vincent, you either opted to go to the States, if you were given that choice, for training over there, or you went to Elmden or Sealand near Chester, just to do the Tiger Moths, and then you went to Canada to do your final flying training.
So if you'd gone to the States, you would have done elementary and...
Yeah, you'd have gone over there, and as my friend Peter told us, he went and did the whole of his training in America, so which meant that he went across the Atlantic before I did, because I was doing my Tiger Moth time. So we got to Greenock, and we sort of looked out, and we couldn't see much because it was a bit misty, and but some, you know how rumours flash around. Somebody said, oh, it's the Queen Elizabeth, it's the QE. Maybe we'll go on that, but you still didn't know. You eventually got shoved into a thing called a lighter, which was like a huge barge, flat bottom thing, with all our kit was at one end, we were all in the other end, and there were what, 40, 50, I don't know how many of us, but and then this thing cast off, and it chugged out into the Clyde. And we were all sort of looking around which ship they were going on. And eventually it was the Queen Elizabeth, which I don't know whether you know, at that time she was the biggest ocean liner. She was probably the fastest ocean liner. She had been launched and just before the war as a luxury liner. I don't think she was ever completed as a luxury liner because the war came, so she was very quickly made into a troop ship. But all the fittings were there. I mean, absolutely wonderful, you know, panelled walls and staircases, and it was quite a luxurious thing. The only problem was there were 7,000 or 8,000 of us on this thing. Yeah, anyway, I can only remember that there was a cabin which was obviously meant for two people when it was built, and I think there were 9 or 10 of us in there in bunk beds. I don't know whether the bunks were 2 tiers or 3 tiers high, but we were jammed in there, absolutely crammed in, and I can't remember this, but friends of mine said it was so crowded that you couldn't sleep all at the same time. You had to share your bunk with somebody else. So when one chap was up, you were in the bunk. I don't remember it being quite as bad as that, but I know there was absolutely no room because you were jammed in this tiny little cabin, all of us, and we got our kit bags in one corner. What I was absolutely certain of, you couldn't all get up and go to bed at the same time because there just physically wasn't room to do that. So there we were, we were all in this thing, and I can remember looking through the porthole, as it was called, in a passenger ship, a scuttle when you're in the Navy, but we looked through this, and I was much more interested because out in the Clyde was one of these escort carriers, one of the first ones I'd ever seen. Don't know which one, but I had a picture of it somewhere. Anyway, just looking through this porthole. But and because the ship was so crowded, I mean, it was crowded mainly with RAF people who were going over to do their training. There were probably 10% of that were like us, Navy, and there were a whole load of Americans who had been over in the UK and were going back home for various reasons, don't ask me why. There were some Canadians going back, and one or two of those had married English girls, so I think they were in special quarters somewhere. So the whole ship was absolutely stock full, and because of the numbers, they could only feed you. You only had 2 meals a day, and if I remember, we had 1 meal at 10 o'clock in the morning, and then another meal at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that was it. And the tannoy used to come over. Troops eating in the first mess hall, on the second sitting, form your line now. And it was all done on a cafeteria basis. But so it was quite an experience. The joy of it was, because she was such a fast ship, there was no need for a convoy. You didn't go in a convoy. She went straight across. No U-boat could catch her or anything like that, so there was no real risk of being torpedoed or anything.
Have there been any trepidation amongst you and your fellow trainees of crossing the Atlantic potentially at that time of the war?
Not really, no. Well, we don't think we gave it a second thought, really. But obviously there was a small risk, I suppose. But the joy of the sail, because of her speed, I think it took us 4 days to... And where did we get to? New York. Now, I mean, what can you say? I mean, we'd been in blacked-out, rationed Britain since 1939, and this was absolute extraordinary. I mean, we'd seen American films, we knew all about the wonderful American life. We came into New York Harbour, past the Statue of Liberty, in the evening. There were the lights of the cars and the lights on the skyscrapers. It was absolute heaven. And there was music coming from somewhere over the loudspeakers, I suppose. And this is just a purely personal note. There were two of us from my school going over. One chap was going over to train in with the Americans, so he hadn't flown at all. Morris Jones eventually became a commander, but he was with me. There were seven others from my school in the RAF, all trainees, and we'd all got together and we were reminiscing about school. And as we came into New York, we were so thrilled. What do? We sang the school song. And I can remember writing a letter to my headmaster telling him this, and it got printed in the Surrey Comet. But it was a wonderful experience. And we sat out in the river that night, and then the next morning they brought this huge ship alongside a pier number 17 or whatever the Americans are, and two piers further down was the Normandy, which had been sunk. I mean, she was the top French liner, and they were converting her to be a troop ship. She'd caught fire, and they'd pumped water into her. The fire department from the 17th precinct or something had come. They flooded her with water, and she just turned over, and there she sat for the rest of the war. Which was a great sound, but we weren't too bothered about that. When we came alongside, what happened? There was this great big band, must have been 40 or 50 of them, and again it was the 16th US New York Police Precinct. I can remember this, not written on the side of somebody's great big drum. And they marched up and down, and they played all the Glenn Miller tunes, and it was just... I mean, we thought, well, why are they doing this for us? But apparently every time a ship docked there, this is what they did.
And it was such a contrast to come from blackout Britain, yeah. Was it, to this amazing...
Oh, extraordinary. I mean, it was a different world. I mean, cars roaring about and, aeroplanes flying. Oh, it was quite a different world.
Given the number of people on board the ship... How easy is it to disembark?
Oh, everything done according to numbers. You had a berthing card or something which told you exactly the number, which deck you were on, which cabin you were in, and everybody had one of these berthing cards, which I think you probably had to show whenever you went for a meal, because otherwise somebody would be getting your share. So we carried this berthing card with you all the time. And when you came to disembark, I don't know whether it was done over the tannoy or notices put up, you were told at what time you had to go to which gangway. And so it was all done quite properly. And, you know, it sounds awful, but everybody knew their place.